You're the big, big boss. You tell me what to do, and I gladly do my job, but I don't like your attitude.
I know people who at Google and elsewhere, for example, they will go away on vacation, and in their out of office message, they will have something like, you know, hi everybody, it's it's Errol here, and I'm out until January 21st. You know, typical out of office messages, I'll get back to you when I return or something, right? But what they do is they say, I will be out, hi, it's Errol, I'm out until January 21st. Not only am I not checking email during that time, when I return, I will be deleting every single email that I received. And it will be up to you to send me that note again, make me a mark it on your calendar. I'll be back on January 21st. So if it's important, make a note.
Now tell me, who do you think you are? Besides a person who happens to be in charge.
Hey everyone, you are listening to the Leadership in Tech Podcast, Season 2. This is Paul Maslany and the Tech On-Ramp, bringing you our 42nd episode. Today we have another interview with another member of Civil, the same company former guest Matthew Isles is from. Today we are interviewing Daniel Seaberg, who before joining Civil worked for CNN for many years, both on TV and on the .com side. Keep listening to hear Zach Ruiz and Errol Dobler interview Daniel and find out how he came to be on TV and what he experienced in his tenure at CNN as well as other companies. He also gets to sharing some thoughts on Civil and explaining what he does there without using the word blockchain, an almost impossible challenge proffered by Zach. Stay with us after the show for more info on the Leadership in Tech podcast series and the Technology On-Ramp, as well as info on Daniel and Civil. We are proud to present the Leadership in Tech podcast series, Season 2, Episode 42, Interview with Daniel Seaberg.
Maybe you got lucky, maybe you worked real hard, and just maybe that doesn't make you smart.
Welcome back, Leadership in Tech Podcast, and our guests just keep getting better and better and better. Today we have Daniel Seaberg on, and if you've ever watched TV, then you've probably seen him, all right? So ABC, CNN, CBS, BBC, the list goes on and on. People he's interviewed, we're going to get into that, but here's really the claim to fame when it comes to Daniel Seaberg. If you get an email from him, well, let me just tell you who's on my email picture in Google. It's not Bono. Okay? Daniel, you have Bono on your picture. You and Bono just chumming up. And that's really all we need to say about our guest. So, Daniel, welcome to the Leadership in Tech Podcast.
Well, thank you. And, I wanted to do Bono a solid, so I appeared in the photo with him. He asked me, and I was like, okay, yeah. I guess I've got time for a photo with you. That was me and my wife stalking him at an event in New York and basically forcing him to do a photo with
so
us.
You grabbed him and got a picture?
It almost came to that. I am a huge U2 fan, and it was one of those opportunities I couldn't let pass. My wife works for Spotify and was mortified that I was stalking him at this event we were at, and has never let me live it down to this day. But he was incredibly accommodating and thankfully didn't shatter my image of him as a decent human being.
Look, Errol is also a bit of a stalker, though, so you guys have that in common.
I'm sure your wife is lovely and is right 99.9% of the time, but I'm with you on this one, okay? You just have to do what you have to do sometimes. And when it comes to snapping a photo with
exactly.
Bob, that's just the way it goes.
Right, right. Yep.
So, look, Daniel, just get us started. Tell us, give us a little bit about yourself. So in the event that some of our audience has been living in a cave, and they've not seen you, give us the Reader's Digest, because we've got a lot we want to ask you.
For sure. Look, Errol, thank you for the introduction, and Zach, great to join you both. So I would say that, mostly in my sort of previous incarnation, I did spend time as a technology correspondent working for the news organizations that you mentioned, CNN, CBS, ABC. Even before that, I had my early days in media and tech at the Vancouver Sun as a reporter there for a couple of years back in the late 90s, covering business and tech trends as they existed back then, bulletin boards, email was new, websites. It was sort of, it's, it feels like such a sort of novel era 20 years ago, the salad days of the web, if you will. But that, that's kind of where I cut my teeth in media and in journalism, and then went on to be a correspondent, quite by accident, actually. If we ever, if we have time to get into the story of how I ended up on television, I'd be happy.
No, we want
to
hear that story. That's yeah. That's the very okay. next question.
Yeah, it's pretty so embarrassing, but but so then I left the sort of full time reporting arena to join Google in 2011, and ended up helping to create a couple of teams there. One called Google for Media, and the other called the Google News Lab. Both of which are intended to support publishers and broadcasters globally around their editorial strategy and how they innovate in storytelling and connect with audiences. And so I did that for about 6 years. And then just a little over 2 months ago, I made the leap to join a startup based in Brooklyn that is focused on blockchain and journalism and the intersection of those two. Very much in the sort of cryptocurrency space that, that's getting a lot of attention these days. And so we're trying to combat things like fake news and figuring out ways to support sustainable journalism. And so I've immersed myself deeply into a space that I really knew nothing about 6 months ago, the blockchain piece of it, but have tried to become something of a mini, well, I wouldn't say expert, but at least somebody who can articulate it better than I could have before that. So anyway, that's a little bit of preamble about me. But I love the spirit of the podcast that, that you all are creating, especially around leadership, and would love to dive into any direction you want to go.
Well, let's get back to Bono. No, I'm just kidding. All right.
So, I don't have his phone number.
Tell us how you got started.
Get him on the Leadership and Tech podcast.
Yeah. Tell us how you got started. You know, you're, I'm going to say, humble Canadian West Coast roots. And then if you want to tell us the embarrassing story about how you got your first job, you can. That's up to you.
Sure. Well, I will share that. I've one of the things that I've learned through my pursuit of being a better person, a better leader, is that transparency can generally serve you better than trying to cover up or hide something or pretend you're better at something than you are. So I had definitely had humble, modest beginnings. I went to journalism school in Vancouver at UBC. I graduated from there and was at the Vancouver Sun for a while. And then I ended up at CNN to be the technology editor for CNN.com back in 2000. And not long after I had started, there was a story circulating about something called the Code Red Worm, which was a virus essentially that was hitting thousands of companies. The FBI was involved. It was sort of early in the days of people being scared of this type of an attack that was spreading. And so CNN needed somebody to go on to talk about it. Although I was working for the .com side, my boss called me up and asked me if I'd come on and talk about it on live television. And I was mortified. I had not had much television experience at all. I was hungover because it was it was the .com world. I just wasn't prepared to be on to television. So I had to borrow like a dress shirt. I had to borrow a tie. I was wearing my glasses. My hair had this, like, if you remember Mark McGrath, my hair sort of had that look with the spiky blonde hair. Anyway, I guess I fit the part of looking like some tech weirdo. And so I went on. It was terrible. Absolutely terrible. Thank God there's no archive online.
I was going to say, I got to see it.
No, it has been purged from the internet forever. But I will tell you, it was so bad. But maybe it was just like watching a train wreck, and the producers were like, we got to put him on again. Anyway, it's sort of the Malcolm Gladwell theory of, you do something for enough hours, you better better get good at it or try doing something else. So, you know, I did it for a number of years at CNN and went on television enough that I think I could kind of fall back on it when I need to. And occasionally would go on as a Google spokesperson, but anyway, it took me in a different direction on a career path that I wasn't anticipating. And I tried to roll with it. And I now look back and think that I took a risk. And this maybe speaks to the sort of the leadership business piece of this. And that is that, you know, I could have sat at my desk and decided that it was too scary or it was outside of my comfort, you know, outside of my comfort zone. And I wasn't as knowledgeable as I wanted to be and just not done it. And I think there are probably, you know, parallels with that in everybody's life, especially in business, where there's something new or different or unfamiliar. And you think, feels a bit uncomfortable to push into that. So I was kind of the human guinea pig of just taking a risk, I guess. And I don't regret it at all. But at the time, it was one of the hardest things that I did. So,
for sure. And then how you got started at CNN?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was sort of the
you tried to glass over that one. So let's get right back to it.
Yeah, well, that was really the foundation of my television career at CNN. I, in parallel with that, worked for CNN.com and helped to manage the website and the technology section for CNN.com, which back then it was so early. I mean, CNN.com was sort of it was a land of misfit toys. There was just a bunch of us working for .com, and CNN was very much focused on television at the time. And the internet was sort of a secondary ancillary track, but very soon became much more of a, you know, something that they were interested in. And obviously it's become such a behemoth today. Most people think of CNN.com as sort of the place for news. I happened to be there during 9/11, which was probably the most sort of seminal moment for me to be in a newsroom, or at least not far from the newsroom. It's a long story, but during 9/11, and to sort of see the reaction that people had, and to actually watch producers adding cable to manage the traffic that was coming into CNN.com that day. And it was pretty amazing. So it sort of struck me. That was kind of my first exposure to, wow, the internet is a real thing when it comes to news, and it's only going to keep growing. And, you know, this is back in 2001. So.
And your story sort of really touches on what we talk about in almost every episode of this podcast, which is taking a tech person who may not have all the soft skills in the world, maybe is a little bit of an introvert, and how can they get out of their comfort zone to do some things besides just coding or besides just writing or whatever. And so you're sort of a good example for someone who took the scary step, right? And look at the doors that's open for you.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that, you know, I also, you know, I've been fascinated with tech and, you know, going back to being a gamer and a, you know, D&D player and just hanging around with all of my sort of tech nerdy friends. I could never have forecast a career in that space. I'm not an engineer. I'm not strong mathematically. I don't consider myself to be sort of a, you know, a logic-based thinker who can kind of process formulas and algorithms and equations. But I have a huge amount of respect for people who can, and I sort of love to watch them talk about it in a way that resonates with people. So I love to be surrounded by those types, you know, the engineers and programmers and coders who can share their knowledge of those sorts of things with me. And as a journalist, I was always eager to then convey that to sort of a broader audience, because I think some of that knowledge of the tech space can get trapped in the heads of people who aren't comfortable sharing it with the public. So I sort of always saw myself as this conduit between, you know, what was happening more technically and then an audience of the public, let's say, who was just trying to figure some of this stuff out.
Yeah, for sure. So you wrote a book, The Digital Diet. It was about 2011, right? Or give or take.
The book came out in 2011.
2011, right. So, and in it, yep. You talk about the myth of multitasking. And one of the things that we talk about on here a lot is, as it pertains to leadership and as it pertains to just how you go about your day, is how multitasking is a myth. And then when we got you on here, I'm looking at your speech from the Digital Disruption in 2013. You're talking about a generation of idiots, perhaps, because of what multitasking does. Can you hit on that a little bit? You know, a little bit about the book, and then, you know, maybe focus a little bit on your thoughts on multitasking.
So the book was driven by my own personal experience and professional experience, I guess, as a technology correspondent who was immersed in all things digital, maybe more so than most people at the time, just by the nature of my job. And so I was the person who had my smartphone out at the dinner table. I was the person annoying everyone around me by posting about an event before it actually finished happening. I was the person who everyone found to be sort of annoying and obnoxious. And my wife in particular was had a nickname for me, which was Glowworm, because I was in bed at night with, like, you know, my laptop or some screen, and, you know, she'd be like, "Oh, great, here's Glowworm again," right? Just couldn't find the right balance with stuff. So anyway, the book was driven just by my own pursuit of figuring the right digital diet and a lot of parallels with food and that kind of thing. And then, and you're right, and in terms of the sort of multitasking piece of it, you know, I do think that multitasking is a myth. I think we're all guilty of trying to do it more than we probably should, whether it's having multiple browser tabs open or trying to do two or three things at once or responding to an email while you're reading something else. I mean, there's a part of that that is sort of unavoidable. What I would say from a leadership standpoint, though, is that the signals that you give as a leader in a work environment in terms of being distracted can be really powerful, and I think sometimes overlooked. So, for example, I can remember, you know, being in a meeting with one of my directors at Google, and when they would be talking to me or listening to something that I was saying, I was always very sensitive to when they would look away to their laptop or pull out their phone. And at any point when that would happen, I would think, "Oh man, am I not interesting anymore? Or is something else better or, you know, more valuable than talking to me right now?" And so being kind of aware of our own behavior as it relates to our employees and our colleagues and other people around us, it sends these messages that maybe we don't intend to send to people, but I think we're all becoming sort of more aware of that. And, you know, even in a meeting, having people put their laptops closed or, you know, just that kind of mental focus that we all really need that, even though we won't allow ourselves to have it sometimes. So anyway, I hope that the book is really meant as kind of a guide, if you will. I think parts of it probably feel a little bit dated now, given everything that's changed so much in the past several years. But I think the theme of it applies maybe more so than it did when I wrote it. So.
Well, I mean, the addiction is...
Let me just say, gross. You are talking Errol's love language with all of these answers. You're hitting on the exact topics that he's been bringing to the show, like every episode. Balance, transparency, distraction. I'm getting a little bit freaked out right now.
Well, great minds think alike. And look, what else can we say? But just, you know, and Daniel, Zach, he's kidding, but he's not kidding. Because these are just the basics. And when I'm talking to a group or coaching an individual, like, we almost start here. And just with what you said, I always relay a story about my commanding officer at SEAL Team 1. I won't go, because our regular listeners will be like, "Why you tell this story every time?" But that guy made you feel like you were the only person in the world when you talk to him. And I'll never forget it. And, you know, one of the things we talk about as a leader, and really as anything, is being in the moment. We just had a guy named Morgan Dix on last week, who's among other things, a meditation expert. And, you know, we were really able to dive deep into being in the moment, what that means. But, you know, to your point, you can either be in the moment checking your phone, or you can be in the moment with whatever else you're doing. Sounds like we're on the same page. So that makes me feel really
good. And so did you find the balance? Like, so being self-described sort of out of balance now in your career, you know, many years later, do you have the balance that you want, or are you still practicing? Like, where did you sort of land?
Yeah, it's a great question. I feel like you'd probably get different answers depending on who you asked in my life. But in terms of my own point of view on it, I think that I'm sort of I consider myself orienting towards seeking balance. So I don't I don't know that I'll ever achieve total balance. It's like trying to get to absolute zero or something. There's no, I don't think that that's even necessarily possible, but I think that to be conscious and aware of the decisions you make and your behavior and how it impacts others is the biggest first step. And then just keeping that as much as you can in the front of your mind when you're dealing with people at work or in your personal life, and just trying to infuse that in everything that you do. And I guess I'm much better than I was. I try to have some parameters. I have some rules. My wife and I don't charge our smartphones in the bedroom, for example. We don't, we sort of try to cut off email or work stuff by about, 8 or 9 o'clock at the latest. We try to keep weekends just for us and our daughters. There are rules that we try to set in place, and sometimes we kind of make that known to people so that they're aware of kind of our own limitations on stuff. But it's tough.
Guidelines and expectations. I mean, Daniel, my God, you are God sent. I mean, that's really just another thing, right? Guidelines. And then what people are expecting when they're around you. And that's,
yeah. And, you know, an out of office message might be one example. I know people who at Google and elsewhere, for example, they will go away on vacation, and in their out of office message, they will have something like, hi everybody, it's Errol here, and I'm out until, January 21st. Typical out of office messages, I'll get back to you when I return or something, right? But what they do is they say, I will be out, it's Errol, I'm out until January 21st. Not only am I not checking email during that time, when I return, I will be deleting every single email that I received. And it will be up to you to send me that note again, make me a mark it on your calendar. I'll be back on January 21st. So if it's important, make a note. And that's, it's interesting, really, it sort of flips the script.
That's,
it flips
a good
the
idea.
Script a bit. Yeah, and it puts the onus a little bit on the sender rather than the receiver. I mean, we've all had to dig our way out of mail jail when we come back from a vacation. It's like the worst half day or day you come back, and it's just a nightmare. And if you allow yourself to check it when you're on vacation, then you're not really mentally giving yourself that kind of separation. So I don't know. I haven't done it personally, just to be clear. But
I love it.
Yeah, it's maybe worth trying for people who are fed up or get too many emails while they're out.
So can you speak? So you're clearly very enlightened on the leadership path, and being in tech your whole life, you're really speaking, the stuff we talk about on this podcast all the time. Having worked at Google, we won't get into Google too much, but we'll just ask this one question. Having worked at Google, the biggest, best tech company in the world with, I don't even know how many employees they have now, 40,000 or more. Do you think that this message is already out there and everybody is doing the same stuff that you already do and know about this? Or is there room for people in tech to benefit from this kind of stuff in their jobs and in their lives?
I think it's a bit of both. The number of employees at Google is now hovering around 80,000, if you can believe it. When I joined, it was somewhere around 21,000 maybe. I am now at a company where I'm employee number 9 out of 12. So that's slightly different number of people. But to your point about, whether they sort of see a balance with tech consumption, I would go speak at events and talk about these types of values, and then people would hear that I work at Google, and they would say, well, isn't that contradictory? How can you, sort of hypocritical to say, find balance with technology and you work at one of the biggest tech companies in the world? You might be surprised by the number of people who work at Google who are even more concerned about these types of issues, and not just Google, but other tech companies, because perhaps they are so much on the vanguard and exposed to this type of behavior on a regular basis that they feel compelled to consider it more or to act on it more. And, there are groups within Google that focus on, issues like distraction and whether there are elements of a product that can help people just know how much time they've spent on something to kind of give them a better sense of sort of the biofeedback of a product saying, hey, you've been using me for 3 hours today, maybe you want to take a break. Or, there's work that Tristan Harris does now. He works with Thrive Global, which is Arianna Huffington's initiative. He used to be a design engineer at Google, and one of the, he was actually tasked with looking for ways that Google products could actually give those types of indicators to people to help them just get a better sense of all the time they're spending on their devices. So, there are it's to varying degrees. I think it probably depends too on whether people have children and how much it affects their own personal life. But it's something that is perhaps more prevalent and thought about than maybe you might think.
Well, I have to hit this topic a little bit, Daniel. And since you were at Google, but now you're gone, we did an entire episode on the Google memo and its relationship to leadership. Can you give us your thoughts on that?
Sure. I mean, it was, as you would expect, it reverberated around Google very quickly and in different ways. I spent a good amount of time reacting to it and talking about it with some of my colleagues within the team that myself and a couple of others helped to lead. We wanted to create a sort of a safe forum for people to ask questions and raise issues and just kind of react to how they felt about it. I think that if there was anything positive that came out of it, it was an opportunity to better address some of the internal training and opportunities to sort of understand either unconscious bias or people's perceptions of engineers and gender and all of that stuff. So much like I think what's happened with the Me Too movement and other kind of really big sort of moments, it galvanizes people and gets them to think about something that maybe they wouldn't have otherwise, if that's maybe part of the silver lining here. I think that there was some amount of debate internally as to whether he should have been fired. I would say that in my experience, anecdotally, most of the people that I talked to and most of my colleagues felt like he should have been fired and that it was the right thing to do. I would say that there was a minority, and not an insignificant minority though, that felt that there was sort of a missed opportunity to perhaps create a dialogue with him at Google and address it in a sort of more internal way, or even then make it into sort of a more public event of some kind. But it was a tough time, and for anybody who worked at Google, that it felt hard to talk about externally with people. There was kind of this sense of, oh boy, it must be rough at Google right now while this is happening. And it was, I think it was really hard for a lot of the executives there. I don't think there was an easy decision. There were some people who were more comfortable with the outcome than others. As the father of two daughters, I like to think that they're going to grow up into a world where they're capable of doing whatever they set their mind to. So it's tough when people have to react to something like that in a corporate environment. But I think it was handled as best as it could have been.
After the incident, I watched some of his interviews, and he didn't really come across to me as a wackadoo. He actually came across to me as very thoughtful, and in his explanations of what he meant, did you watch a lot of his interviews after the fact, and did you take away that maybe he was misunderstood a little bit, or were you pretty solid on where you stood on the issue the entire time?
I don't know that I've ever become solid on where I stand on the issue, to be honest. I mean, I think and this is maybe why it's so difficult for people to process some of what he's... I mean, I took... me personally, I took offense to some of the things that he said. It also felt like he was retreading an argument that had been processed and discussed in the past, and that he was presenting it almost as though he had kind of discovered this in some way or something, whereas it's not exactly a new point of view for someone to hold, but he was sort of coming at it with a slightly different perspective, different sort of ways to present evidence, I guess. But I think the struggle for a lot of people at Google was, should there have been an opportunity to create a really open arguably contentious dialogue about it, which is what Google has been known for in the past. Every week, there's something called TGIF, which is where any employee at Google can ask the highest executives at Google anything they want. And it's a pretty amazing sight to watch. I mean, I would watch them almost every week. And, you know, the most junior person at Google could ask Sundar whatever they thought was important, or, you know, could critique something in an open forum like that, which is pretty unusual. At least it certainly was unusual when Google started this. And so there were, you know, that's the sort of idea of a free speech environment, if you will, is such a part of Google's DNA that I think that some people wrestled with what seemed like a very sort of sudden and abrupt way to kind of end a potential discussion. So I don't know. I haven't honestly thought about it a whole lot since it happened, but it certainly was a moment of reckoning for a number of people at the company, for sure.
Well, onward from the Google.
I know time is short for you, Daniel, so let's do one last question and let you go, but you have to promise to come back on because you're talking about so much stuff that is so interesting to us.
And I would love to.
The wheelhouse of what we like to talk about. Last, I'm going to put you on the spot and throw out like a challenge that I think we talked about briefly when we first met a couple of weeks ago. Yep. Describe what you're doing now and what you're going to be doing for the next year or two or 5 years, but do not use the word blockchain.
Can I use the word cryptocurrency, or do I have to stay away from that?
Yes, you may. Just don't say blockchain.
Okay. Well, let's see. What I'm doing right now is serving as a co-founder and head of journalism operations for a company called Civil, which our intended goal is to create a marketplace of sustainable journalism, which means content that people will pay for, in a decentralized manner. So today, when you go to consume a lot of news content, particularly through social channels, it has been centralized either by a media organization or a social media organization or whatever it is. There's not a lot of opportunity to go peer-to-peer from somebody who's creating the news to the audience. And what we are trying to do is to create the right framework for people to access and pay for content through cryptocurrency, but we're also thinking there as well, at least in the beginning, and then use this kind of new architecture of peer-to-peer decentralized technology to enable I'm trying to phrase this the right way. It's just a harder challenge than I thought it would be. What this type of technology that rhymes with
blockchain,
blockchain
is all about is it creates this kind of a trust or sort of a trustless network, if you will. And as a result of that, we think that there are aspects that will apply to journalism that can tackle things like fake news and better fact checking, a permanence to the content so that, you know, if a billionaire who's funding a local newspaper decides to pull away, all of that great archive doesn't disappear from the web thanks to the rock vein.
Right.
And so there's a lot that's involved with this. We are really excited about the possibility. We've had a lot of momentum around it. And it's exciting for me to be part of a startup that's in this space, in particular between news and the technology that we're using, because from a leadership point of view, it's interesting because right now we're quite a flat group. There are only 12 of us. We're a little distributed. We all have sort of remits within the startup, but we also There's not a hierarchy that's been established at this point. So there's a lot of people just figuring out how to work together. And that's kind of a different type of leadership, I feel like, where you're not managing a team per se, but you have to bring leadership attributes to sort of everything you do in a way that also accommodates other people's leadership, because it's a bit like everybody's leading. So how does that work, right? And so there's kind of a respect and a dynamic there that's interesting. And it's kind of, I'm finding it really interesting to explore. And I definitely don't consider myself an expert on that. But you know, coming off, I had a chance to take a number of different leadership courses at Google, and I really, really value leaders who can display that kind of vulnerability and transparency, and to say, I'm learning alongside you. And, you know, yes, some people have to make decisions and sort of drive things forward, but, you know, there's kind of a pulling everybody up with you as you go. And, you know, that's, I think, kind of where we're at right now with Civil. So
we had Matthew on, and I fell in love with the whole concept. I wrote a post about it. I'm really into disruptive leadership, and in my mind, that's what Matthew and Civil and you are doing, really just challenging that big beast that's media right now, and it's time. Even if you lied to us and said you didn't really mean you were going to come back, you already said that you're going to come back. So here are what we want to talk about coming back now. So we do want to talk about Civil a little more, your thoughts on coming from the journalist world and what Civil looks like and what that disruption really means. I'm really interested. You said you did Google for Media, you know, kind of the comparison and contrast there with Civil and what you're doing now. Mm-hmm. And I've got to know the top five and bottom five people that you've ever interviewed. I've got to know who the most boring people are. And
well, that's for next time.
I have to name the most boring people.
No, but you can say they rhyme with. So in other words, Bono, like I interviewed a guy and he rhymes with Ono.
Yeah. So, no one would ever know. You guys are fantastic. I would love to come back. Props to Matthew. I'm glad that you've spoken with him. I don't know if he's going to listen to this. He probably doesn't have to necessarily the bandwidth as CEO of a startup, but he's had to make some pretty tough decisions as a young CEO. I can say young because I am much older than him, but he's had to make some really tough decisions, and he's demonstrated to me a maturity and a vision and a sort of a leadership poise that I think is extremely hard to manage effectively with a startup, and to keep people rowing in the right directions and galvanize people's energy, especially in a new space that most people are still trying to figure out. So I my hat's off to him. There are, you know, a number of us on the team who have all sorts of different backgrounds, and, you know, trying to pull this Civil idea into something that exists in the world. And March will be our token sale, and then April is our intended launch. So we'll hopefully get there. And I would love to chat either as we get closer or around that time.
Yeah, you know, and we do. We really want you back to talk about that. We'll let you go. We know you've got some other pressing, more important issues to deal with, like going to pick up the kids. That matters. So thank you again, Daniel. We really appreciate your time, and we really can't wait to have you back on really soon.
Truly my pleasure. I love what you guys are up to. Thank you so much for having me, and I will be glad to do part two, heck, a part three if you'll have me.
All right. That sounds good.
Awesome.
All right.
Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Leadership in Tech podcast is brought to you by the Technology OnRamp. For more on Daniel, go to joincivil.com, where you can find their email signup and their Slack signup. For the Civil Slack signup, you can go directly to civil-slack-signup.herokuap. CivilOnPP.com. You can also find Civil on Medium and Twitter. Both are at @join_civil. If you're looking for more comprehensive show notes and an episode outline, or just to learn more about the Leadership in Tech podcast or the Technology On-Ramp, go to www.techonramp.com. You can find all of our episodes there, as well as our blog, info on our nonprofit, the Tech On-Ramp, and much, much more. This show is available on YouTube, iTunes, Google Play Music, SoundCloud, and Player FM. For more about the companies involved in making this possible, check out Salt.io at www.salt.io and Leader193 at www.leader193.com. Tune in next Thursday for the next episode of the Leadership in Tech podcast, presented to you by the Technology On-Ramp.
Tell me what to do, and I gladly do my job, but I don't like your attitude. I don't like your attitude.